From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As the acting director of the FBI testifies today on Capitol Hill, a new narrative is emerging about why former FBI director James Comey was fired, and it's in conflict with some of the initial statements from the White House. Joining us on Skype is Ashley Parker, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, give us a sense, and you report on this today in The Washington Post, of what you know about what was going on behind the scenes before the decision to fire Comey was made.
Well, I mean, there was a lot going on behind the scenes, and a lot of that contradicts the White House narrative that basically they only made the decision to fire Comey after the Deputy Attorney General came to them with these set of concerns. What we know is that this had been building for a very long time, and a lot of it was tied to Comey conducting the FBI investigation into Donald Trump's campaign in Russia. And Trump had sort of grown in, had always been skeptical of him. Comey is one of these love or hate people, and, you know, Trump loved it when he was hurting Hillary and hated it when he was investigating Trump. But there was sort of this slow burn. So everything from Comey refusing to back up Trump's, you know, evidentless claim that Obama had wiretapped his campaign headquarters, to Comey going before a Senate committee and saying under oath that the FBI was in fact investigating possible Russian collusion in the 2016 presidential elections. And Trump sort of felt that Comey was trying to turn himself into a martyr over and using the Russia issue to do so, and, you know, was a little sanctimonious. And Trump this weekend at his Bedminster golf course had basically made up his mind to fire him, and came in Monday and told a small group of aides that Comey had to go, and then sort of used the concerns from Attorney General Sessions and from his deputy, Rod Rosenstein, to sort of justify it. But at that point, the president had already, according to our reporting, made a decision.
Well, and you report also that Rosenstein had threatened to resign because the White House was putting so much of the blame on Rosenstein and Sessions for Trump making this decision.
Exactly. You know, he did write that memo, and it's a little unclear to me how he thought it would be used. And he did seem to have real concerns with how the FBI director handled some of the investigation into Hillary Clinton. But, you know, he did not call for the FBI director to be fired. He was certainly uncomfortable with the way he was sort of blamed as the scapegoat. And then, yes, he threatened to resign.
As people have been looking at how this has all unfolded, many have pointed out that there's been what looks like disarray at the White House, that they don't really have their ducks in a row in how to roll this out, how to respond to questions about it. They're contradicting some of the things that they were saying in the beginning. What struck you about that?
I think that's certainly a fair assessment. I mean, I would say briefly in defense of the White House communications shop, which has often had some issues getting their message out. But in this case, what we learned was that White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer and White House Communications Director Mike Dubke literally were given basically an hour heads up before the news started to break. And some of the lower level staff at the White House and in the communications shop, you know, didn't even learn until their phones buzzed with a public news alert. So you have a White House given no time to try to message a very tough thing to message, and it was very scrambled. You had Sean Spicer walk into the briefing room and read a very brief statement. Then the White House said there would be no more comments that evening. And then, as we reported, the president, he goes back to his residence to eat dinner, and he does what he always does, which is he watches cable news and he grows increasingly angry because he sees there's no one out there defending him. And he had sort of expected to get praise for this move, and certainly not the backlash he got. And he becomes increasingly agitated and irate and orders his comm shop, you know, we need people on TV defending me. I want Kellyanne on CNN. Get people out there. So then the White House, that had planned for no public statements, they suddenly have to rush all these people out on television. They held sort of a late night briefing in the dark, you know, kind of in front of these hedges in the White House driveway to try to answer some of the questions. I mean, it was not sort of the finely tuned machine you would want to handle something as explosive as this.
Do we have any sense at this point of who will be the next FBI director?
I personally do not. I can tell you, you know, some of sort of like the fun names we've heard in the rumor mill is Rudy Giuliani, of course, who certainly did not like Comey and had been sort of whispering in Trump's ear to fire him. Chris Christie, former Senator Kelly Ayotte. I mean, those are sort of some of the big names.
But these are people, all of them, that would not be seen by many Democrats as acceptable, given how close they are to President Trump.
Sure. I mean, I think Democrats and even some Republicans are already sort of worried that the reason Comey was sidelined was not for the stated reason of he had just been so unfair to Hillary Clinton, but because Trump was unhappy that Comey was ramping up this investigation into, you know, Russia meddling in the 2016 election. And so I think it is going to be very tough to find a new FBI director who everyone, but especially the Democrats, feel confident in to sort of carry out the duties of the job in a, you know, fair, nonpartisan way and continue this ongoing investigation.
That's Ashley Parker, a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Ashley, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
People in Knoxville, Tennessee, without employer-provided insurance, looking to buy coverage through the state exchange, will be able to for next year. This week, Blue Cross Blue Shield announced it's re-entering the Knoxville market just 3 months after the only remaining insurer there, Humana, said it was pulling out. That would have left people in Knoxville with no option to buy individual insurance as mandated by the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. So what does the Blue Cross re-entry mean in the bigger picture? Max Blau is Southern correspondent for our partners at STAT, the Health Medicine publication. And Max, Blue Cross Blue Shield sent a letter to Tennessee's insurance commissioner explaining their decision. It had 3 points. One, that they feel there had been volatility in the exchanges and Blue Cross was losing money before, but things have calmed down a bit.
Yeah, I think from Blue Cross Blue Shield's perspective, they saw risk lower over the past year. And to some, they have seen that as a sign of maybe that Obamacare is not collapsing in the way that Republican lawmakers around this country have suggested it is collapsing in terms of that there's no hope for insurers to provide insurance to residents in places like Knoxville. However, you know, to make this work for Blue Cross Blue Shield, they are expecting to see rates increase in terms of premiums. And while things will be slightly better for Knoxville residents, they should also be bracing for health insurance increases in costs over the next year come 2018.
Right. Well, you quote Larry Levitt, who's senior vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. He marked up the letter, as you say, on Twitter. He interpreted the paragraph from Blue Cross Blue Shield where they said, you know, while it was pretty rocky, we had volatility, we had losses, our 2017 performance has improved because of better claims experience, a more sustainable rate structure based on the medical needs of members we're serving. So Larry Levin interpreted this. He scribbled on the letter, ACA not collapsing. There were some who have said that the problem with Obama's Affordable Care Act is it does need tweaking. It does, you know, insurance companies do need help coming into these exchanges. So some are interpreting that as Blue Cross Blue Shield saying, you know, we're thinking things have calmed down a bit. But they're also looking ahead to the Republican health plan. And Blue Cross Blue Shield seems to be critical of that in this letter, saying that they're thinking there's going to be even more of a need. Explain that paragraph.
Yeah, absolutely. They are hedging their bets here, I think, with this letter. They are, on one hand, committing to be in the marketplace for 2018, but this is not a long-term commitment. This is not a guarantee for 2019 or 2020. Much of that, as you suggested, is related to the AHCA. And
the Republican plan, yeah.
Yes, and as part of that, there are certain things that help reduce the risk from Blue Cross Blue Shield's perspective. Some of those are key tenets of Obamacare. It is individual mandates that require people to buy insurance or to have insurance of some kind to help offset some of the risk from individuals who either had chronic conditions, pre-existing conditions, or other expensive healthcare costs.
Well, you mentioned that the premiums are going to be higher, and Blue Cross Blue Shield seems to be saying we're going to have to price in some of these potential changes down the road, risks that include but are not limited to the elimination of cost-sharing reduction subsidies. Under Obamacare, very low-income people had some subsidies to help them afford insurance. The removal of the individual mandate. Again, Blue Cross Blue Shield saying if that goes, we're going to have to raise our premium because we won't have healthier people, and the collection of the health insurer tax. So they're cautioning that some of the things that Republican House plan included will make it probable that they'll have to price in those downside risks, as Blue Cross Blue Shield puts it. They also say, though, that they feel that they have a responsibility.
Absolutely. And you've seen this from Blue Cross Blue Shield in Arizona last year. There was a county, Pinal County, it's a rural county. I believe it was about 10,000 people who live there. We're faced with a situation where the last insurer pulled out, and for a moment through late last summer, we're facing a scenario where there was no one to buy insurance from in their exchange. And at the last minute, Blue Cross Blue Shield decided to step in, and that was seen as a good thing. However, for people who live there, premiums increased by over 50% there. So while Blue Cross Blue Shield has, in multiple states, shown a commitment to stepping in where no other insurers were left, they're anticipating higher costs in doing that and are building in premium hikes in the short term in case, you know, any of these changes happen in terms of the Affordable Care Act's repeal.
Max Blau, Southern correspondent for our partners at STAT. Max, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Anxiety is building on the Navajo Nation in northern Arizona over the fate of nearly 1,000 jobs connected to the West's largest coal-fired power plant. As we've reported, operators of the Navajo Generating Station say they're shutting down in 2019 because the plant can't compete with the low cost of natural gas. That means the coal mine that supplies the plant could be shutting down too, unless tribal officials can come up with a new plan. Here now is Peter O'Dowd, went to this remote spot and found a story about coal, jobs, and the environment different from any other in America.
It's different for one because to many Navajos, the land that holds the coal is sacred.
The lack of access is a blessing in a lot of ways, in that we get to live a life that we chose to live.
Getting to Herb Yazzie's ranch takes several hours from the nearest city in a truck with very high clearance. But once the trek is over and you step outside, it sounds as if a mute button has been hit. It's just Yazzie and me, the sky, and a few cows scampering by.
And these animals are part of that. They're essential to instill the sacredness of all of this to the young kids.
And where does that coal mine that's just over the hill fit into all this?
It doesn't fit. As far as I know, there are no sacred songs for coal. There's no prayers for coal.
Yazzie's lived around here for more than 50 years, long before miners started pulling coal from the earth about a mile away. Since the 1970s, Peabody's Kayenta coal mine has fueled the Navajo Generating Station.
It's a problem. The blasting creates the dust. The coal dust that drifts, unfortunately, towards our area, like a fog.
So when you got the news earlier this year that the Navajo Generating Station would be shutting down far earlier than it was expected, and that because of that, this mine would most likely be shutting down along with it, what did you think?
Let it be. Let it expire. Because the way we look at it is, we've had enough of the destruction and the pollution.
So you celebrate the decision.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people don't, right? I mean, a lot of people would say there's a lot of jobs that mine provides, and there's a lot of jobs that the generating station provides. And this is a poor place.
Well, you know, what's your definition of a poor place? If you live according to the teaching of the holy people and the traditional people, we've been destroying the land. We've been participants in this destruction. Our natural resources has been exploited. And so let's quit this.
So the wealth to you is in the land itself.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Let me ask you another question, because one of the fascinating things I think about this mine that's just over that bluff is that the black rock that comes out of it gets transported to the Navajo Generating Station. It gets burned up into electricity. And it helps supply millions of people across the Southwest with power. And it moves tons and tons of water from the Colorado River to Phoenix and to Tucson. Isn't that important, though? I mean, how do you see that?
Well, it's to benefit others. That's always been the purpose. We've got taken. We got exploited.
Peabody would not tape an interview for this story, but a spokeswoman says the company has been a good neighbor over the years by providing more than 300 high-paying local jobs, restoring much of the land back to its natural state, and giving locals access to fuel for heating and much-needed water.
A lot of people are going to be out of work, so that's the only problem. And if they shut the power plant,
they depend on it. We get water, resource, stuff like that.
I met John Davis and his wife next to a Peabody wellhead just down the road from Herb Yazzie's ranch. John is filling four buckets in the back of his pickup. Like many people on this remote reservation, the Davis family has no running water, so they come here every other day to fill up.
For us local, we need coal to burn in the wintertime, so it'd be a misfortune for us, you know.
So you go down to the dock where you can actually pick up coal and buy it and put it in the back of your truck. You do that?
Yeah.
So for you, this coal mine's important.
Yeah.
But some of those benefits will dry up if Peabody leaves. Not far from the well, this conveyor belt carries coal to a train, which loads up and then chugs along to the power plant 80 miles to the west. Peabody is willing to lower its prices to keep the operation moving, and that's something the Navajo and neighboring Hopi tribes would like to see. The power plant and the coal mine provide them with millions of dollars in royalties every year. So when this belt stops, so will the money.
Well, we would end up with basically nothing to a large extent.
Daniel Hanani is the executive director of the Hopi Tribal Government. The reservation is tucked away inside the much larger Navajo Nation, essentially cutting Hopis off from the outside world. 80% of its general fund comes from mine royalties, and Hanani says losing it will crush a vital source of money to pay government salaries on a reservation where well over half the population is already unemployed.
In some cases, we have as many as 3 to 4 families living in a household. They are overcrowded in their home. Kids can't study. And because we have limited jobs here on the reservation, it's a stressful situation, and they're getting into drugs and alcohol.
You knew this was coming in a way, right? Yes. You could see what was happening with the cost of natural gas and with the coal in general in this country. So why weren't you better prepared? Why is so much of your budget still reliant on that coal?
It's the only source that we have that we've ever taken a look at. And the information was that we had major supply of coal, and there's going to always be a need for it until 2044. And so I'm not saying that we were complacent. We have difficulty in doing our own economic development.
My name is Catherine Kwahoyoma, and I am the court administrator for the Hopi Tribal Court.
What does the closure of the mine mean to you?
Closure of the mine, to me, will mean insufficient court services.
The reality of life without coal is starting to sink in across the reservation. At the tribal courthouse, a pink portable building off the highway, Koyakahoma says her budget relies on the general fund. The judges' jobs are on the line. Hers could be too. What about beyond the justice system? Are you worried as a citizen, as a member of the Hopi community, about all the other things that the general fund provides?
Yes. We're just going to be abandoned. It seems like we're just going to be abandoned out here, you know, out so far out in this area if we lose some of those services.
And then what?
I think as a Hopi woman, I probably have the means to survive. Our culture teaches us how to plant corn, how to take care of it, how to basically have basic survival skills. So if it comes to that, I could say at that point that I'm a rich Hopi woman because I have a lot of corn.
Hopi officials don't believe it's realistic that Hopi people will just return to the land. They're actually more concerned that layoffs will force families to leave the reservation and erode the tribe's tradition along with it. But all of this misses the point, according to Percy Deal. He lives on a hillside where the wind has room to run.
Look at this house. Look at...
Deal opens a gate to his garden and says people like him have never benefited from mine royalties.
See, look, it's split in apart. And
there's a crack in the wall here.
Yeah. And the windows are all inadequate.
and the dirt roads are impassable when it rains. Above all, there's no running water. It's too expensive for homeowners to dig a private well, but the mine and the plant combined use billions of gallons of water every year for people who live far away from this parched hillside.
See, I got rain gutter here. You come down in here, and then another one on that side.
So what we're looking at right now is you've got your rain gutter system that's on top of your house, and it drips into another
55-gallon drum.
Yeah.
Now.
And so what do you use that water for?
I'll show you.
Deal takes the cover off a stack of buckets, and inside there's a purifying filter.
Right there. See how clean that thing is?
Fresh water.
Yeah.
You can drink it.
You can drink it. If I had a cup, I would let you taste it.
It so happens I have a bottle in the truck. There's a little spigot. Okay, hold on a second. Here we go. Okay.
Taste it.
All right, so this is your filtered rainwater.
Yep.
It's delicious.
Oh, yes.
It tastes great. So when we're talking about this coal mine and the Navajo Generating Station, in relation to all this, what do you think?
The water belongs to us. It belongs to me. And it doesn't do me any good to have Peabody using it. I don't get a drop of it.
So you're not sorry to see them go?
I'm not sorry at all. I'm happy that they're going to... I want them to go at the earliest time.
For now, the mine is on track to keep digging coal until 2019, and Percy Deal will continue his trips to the public well to fill the 55-gallon drums that are scattered in piles around his yard. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
About 3 o'clock this morning in New Orleans, protesters made their voices heard as a crew removed a statue of Jefferson Davis. New Orleans is just one of many southern cities that's been removing monuments to the Confederacy. Vernon Burton is a history professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. And Vernon, when we think back to when a lot of this started, which was when the Confederate battle flag came down at the State House in South Carolina, and we look at what's happening in New Orleans, is there something different about New Orleans that has made people so upset about the statues there?
Well, I think it's different. You have to look at each situation very differently. This is just one of several monuments that have come down in New Orleans. I think the one that was most notorious was the one that celebrated a coup d'etat and celebrated terrorists who overthrew the United States government. So there are various different degrees of which the monuments celebrate different things. People would look at Jefferson Davis and see this much more as part of the Confederacy or the ideas they have of the Confederacy. We usually think that victors write the history of wars, but with the American South and the Civil War, white Southerners particularly, with a lot of sympathetic Northerners, wrote an account sort of mystifying the South and tried to avoid as much as they could saying that the war was about slavery. When if you look back at what people said the war was about, when the southern states seceded from the Union, they claimed at the top of their voices, they minced no word and said, this is about preserving slavery as an institution. But that's not the way people have remembered it, and it's become this heritage issue. At the same time, I really think that it's important that people understand why these monuments are being removed, that to a large group of Southerners, that is African Americans who are also Southerners and help make this Southern culture very offensive and represents to them the attempt both to overthrow the United States government and leaving it, that is fighting against it, but to enslave and a commitment to white supremacy.
Do you think that 5 years from now, there are going to be many of these monuments to the Confederacy left in the South?
I do think there will be some left. I really do. What I am hoping as a historian, because we don't want to completely forget what people remembered and why they remembered it. But I hope we'll have alternative statues to our identity. For instance, all the incredibly great African-American leaders and their contributions. You know, the state I know best, South Carolina, there's not a single African-American on the state house ground. There's one name of an African-American on the state house ground, but that's Strom Thurmond's African-American daughter, which was added lately. So I think we need a much more balanced, and also to tell the whole story of what the Confederacy is about, what the Confederate leaders did. People are complicated. They really are. So I think a monument is difficult to actually, on a few words, encapsulate what a person stands for.
That's Vernon Burton, who is a professor of history at Clemson University. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy. Always a pleasure.
President Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey is drawing some historical comparisons. Not since Watergate has a president dismissed the person leading an investigation into his administration. For a look back at that history and more, let's go to Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks.
And let's start with the Watergate scandal, which has gotten so much of attention, a lot of people making comparisons to Watergate. Bring us back to the situation back then.
Well, the situation was pretty dire. I mean, the investigation of President Nixon's campaign skullduggery had moved from a simple question of a break-in to all kinds of questions about a cover-up that was leading closer and closer to the White House. The Attorney General had appointed a special prosecutor and named Archibald Cox. And as that investigation got closer and closer to the president himself, the president decided to fire that special prosecutor. It became known as a Saturday Night Massacre because the Attorney General resigned, refusing to fire the special prosecutor. The associate attorney general resigned, and then the solicitor general, third in line, finally fired Archibald Cox.
Although the FBI director was never fired by Nixon.
The FBI director was not fired.
And we should also say that people compare everything to Watergate. That's why they put a gate on the end of every single scandal. I mean, do you think it's fair to compare the firing of James Comey and Sally Yates, I guess, if we want to go back, and all the attorneys, including Preet Bharara? Do you think that it's fair to compare what's happening now to Watergate?
Well, I mean, I think you have to go back a lot further in just thinking about the importance of the FBI as an American institution and as one among a number of bureaucracies in the mid-20th century that have a pretty, ironclad set of guidelines and rules that give them power and access to resources. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover, as the head of the FBI, was one of a number of bureaucrats who were able in many instances to deflect the power of elected officials. And in a lot of ways, you know, Hoover's history is somewhat exceptional in the longer history of the agency itself.
Well, let's talk about J. Edgar Hoover, who served in that role as head of the FBI for almost 50 years. In fact, the way that FBI directors are named and how long they can serve is different post J. Edgar Hoover than it was for him.
Yeah, it's very different. The fact that Hoover served from, I think, 1924 into the 1970s meant that he had accumulated such an incredible amount of power. In fact, for our younger listeners, they should understand that it was more likely that Hoover could fire a president, I'm kind of exaggerating there a little bit, then a president could fire J. Edgar Hoover. There were a couple of presidents who would have loved to fire Hoover. Harry Truman was one of them because Truman's opponent, Thomas Dewey, got some help from J. Edgar Hoover, who had no love for Truman, thought he was soft on communism. But ultimately, Truman backed off because he just didn't know what J. Edgar Hoover had on him, and he was seen as an icon even back in the 40s. And John F. Kennedy had no love for J. Edgar Hoover, but ultimately Kennedy was afraid to fire J. Edgar Hoover. He left him in place. That's how powerful J. Edgar Hoover was.
Yeah, even his most overt political adversaries wouldn't even threaten to call for Hoover's resignation. You know, you think about somebody like Martin Luther King Jr., in December of 1964, King is very forceful in trying to explain to the American public and even, you know, to blame Hoover directly in correspondence for not pursuing prosecutions against the acts of terrorism committed against African Americans in 1961 in Albany, Georgia. The bombing in Birmingham in 1963 goes unprosecuted by the FBI. 1964, Freedom Summer, three civil rights workers, again, infamously killed there. No real involvement or vigorous investigation from the FBI. And even in calling out J. Edgar Hoover, King takes a somewhat deferential tone in correspondence and basically says that, you know, he understands that, you know, Hoover is a great American who's operating under a lot of strain and pressure, and he has sympathy for someone who has served the country so well. So even when he's trying to call the FBI director out for literally not doing his job, he never even gets close to calling for Hoover's resignation.
Hmm. Well, after Hoover died, there was a new confirmation process for the FBI director. The director was nominated by the president after that and confirmed by the Senate and could only serve a 10-year term. Now, take us back to the last time the FBI director was fired, which was in 1993.
So that would be William Sessions, and he was under investigation by the Office of Professional Responsibility for doing a variety of things, including not paying taxes on limos that took him to and from the office, billing the government for a $10,000 security fence at his home, taking business trips that included his wife, and they met with relatives in the meantime. And even with all of those indiscretions, Clinton waited on word from Attorney General Janet Reno before proceeding with the firing, right? So it was certainly a moment that was exceptional in the history of the Bureau, but it had to be handled with the utmost care, given the fact that the FBI office was in large measure kind of insulated from this kind of rebuke.
So what about what happens now? People are concerned that President Trump is going to nominate maybe one of his close advisors, but they want somebody who is independent, who can, by the way, take on this investigation into Russia and connections with the Trump campaign. What is the history of the FBI director being independent or a close pal of the president's?
When you get someone as powerful as J. Edgar Hoover, you get a lot of independence. Mm-hmm. We spent really a couple of decades reacting to that kind of independence on the part of a bureaucrat. We built in the limitation on the FBI director's term, as you talked about, Jeremy. Mm-hmm. We increased congressional oversight. We created mechanisms for actually being able to look at the records that the FBI was collecting. So what's the product of all of these safeguards against too much independence? You guessed it. A lot more political clout for the person who appoints the FBI director. But I do want to make one important historical point. And it goes back to what you said, Jeremy. The FBI director was not fired during Watergate. And it's very important to point out that the person who was deep throat, who was feeding crucial information to the journalists pursuing the Watergate story, was the number two guy at the FBI, we now know, a guy named Mark Felt. So when you ask what's going to happen, if there are dedicated public servants within the FBI today, they're going to continue their investigation. And even if they're thwarted by the leadership, they may find ways to provide the information they are discovering. On the other hand, we live in a remarkably partisan era, really quite different than the Watergate era, where you have people from the minority party, the Republican Party, like Senator Howard Baker from Tennessee, who really was an incredible hero for pursuing the truth in Watergate, even though he was a Republican and there was a Republican president.
And if people inside the FBI do decide to leak information about the investigation, maybe 40 years later, we will find out who they are. Well, like, you know, Mark Felt, right?
Right. I mean, it's also, I think, important to keep in mind that this is a lot of this is being invented as we go along. And we are in the business, obviously, of thinking about parallels to earlier presidencies. But, you know, I tell you, Jeremy, we might be thinking about this thing all wrong, just in one crucial way, which is that perhaps the norms and the kinds of conventions that are abiding in the presidency don't fit. And we should think about the history of business, right? I mean, for Donald Trump to go and be able, at least in his own, you know, kind of political cosmology, fire an acting attorney general, fire a national security advisor, fire an FBI director, the U.S. attorney for Southern New York State, and a few more, right? I mean, this is somebody who actually is behaving like a business. And so business history teaches us that you should be able to fire someone and the problem should go away, right? But in government, when you fire somebody, you get a public hearing, you get backlash, you get blowback. And, you know, Trump's own tweets suggest that he's kind of befuddled by the response that he's getting right now, in part because he's been approaching this as a businessman in large measure. And if anything else, it shows us the limits of trying to operate government like a business.
That's Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
It has been more than 2 months since the small city of Olathe, Kansas, was rocked by a violent crime that made national and international news.
Police hunting for a gunman after three people are shot at an Olathe bar. Right,
it's now, happened in Kansas, in the United States. We're getting the details as
we
well.
Turn now to a developing headline coming in from Kansas City tonight, where a suspect.
Headlines there from ABC, CNN, but also India Today, because on February 22nd at that bar in Olathe, Adam Purinton allegedly told two Indian men to get out of my country, then shot both, killing Srinivas Kuchibotla, an engineer at the GPS company Garmin. Garmin is Olathe's biggest private sector employer, part of the reason behind a tech boom in the city. Unemployment there is around 3%, median income around $80,000. A Whole Foods came to town recently, as did a Hindu temple. But after the shooting back in India, the father of the young man killed told other Indians, don't go to the U.S. So what's been the impact or the reaction to President Trump's scrutiny of the H-1B visa program used by tech companies to bring in skilled foreign workers? Ramesh Ratnasar wrote about Olathe today in this week's Bloomberg Business Week. Ramesh, there was fear in the Indian community after the shooting, but also an outpouring of support. How important are these workers who've emigrated to the economy of Olathe?
Well, Olathe's population has increased by more than 40% since 2000. And that has really been driven by the growth of the technology sector and the healthcare sector. And what you see is in both of those industries, Indian Americans and others, skilled workers from other parts of the world, are vital. And so if you look at Olathe, for instance, the number of people who work in the STEM field, so science, technology, engineering, is around 8-9%, which is about double the rate in the rest of the country. And if you look at the size of the Indian American community in Olathe, it's now close to 8%. So it's the second largest source of immigrants after Mexico, and that's double what you would see nationally. So immigrants, in particular skilled immigrants, largely from India but also from some other parts of the world, have been absolutely key to the city's evolution.
Well, you paint this wonderful history of Olathe and the region and how it was once home to bootmaking and Belgians came in. But this seems pretty extraordinary. Since the opening of King Radio in 1960, a company that specialized in radios for small airplanes, et cetera, and then two workers there broke off, if I got this right from your writing. In 1995, Garmin, their company, which was in a neighboring town, moved to a $8 million facility in Olathe. They've just spent more than $100 million expanding their campus in Olathe. I mean, you know, talk about this tech hub in the middle of that state.
Well, it's fascinating because Olathe, and when I talk to people who'd lived there and whose families have been there for generations, they'll say that the city is pretty much the same as it was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. It's still a place where most people know each other on a first name basis. But at the same time, really over the last, I'd say, 20 to 30 years, you've seen this growth of technology companies and Garmin being the most prominent one. And what that's done is it's made the city different. It's made it a more diverse place. There are now 84 languages spoken in Olathe's public schools. You know, if you visit Olathe, what you see is office parks and office towers kind of sprouting up in the plains. And you just sort of see this sprawling sense of growth.
You talk to people like Chad Scheer, a researcher who said this part of Kansas has basically subsidized the rest of the state, doing so well. In the past 10 years, Johnson County has accounted for half of Kansas's population growth, 65% of its new jobs, according to the County Economic Research Institute. So it is an engine. It is a driver. The people who have been there for decades, who don't feel that they're losing their small town feeling, do they fear that not just that terrible shooting incident, but also the language coming from the Trump administration about cutting back on these skilled workers' abilities to get these visas to come here, do they worry what that will do to the growth?
I think there is concern. I think people feel that they have really benefited from this transformation of the city's economy. You know, it's interesting, you know, that there's this whole debate about the H-1B visas. And one of the proposals is to raise the floor for what you would pay someone who is on an H-1B visa from, I think it's about $65,000. There's some proposals out there to raise it to as high as $100,000. And what people in Olathe said is that that simply would just be much more than they could pay. And as a result, they would have to just look elsewhere or find other alternatives for filling those positions. And in some cases, they told me they might have to leave the state. Mm. And if they can't continue to bring in this talent and they're forced to go elsewhere, that just means that there are fewer jobs in the state. That means lower tax revenues. And that's going to ultimately hurt the state and all of its citizens.
That's Ramesh Ratnasar. We'll link you to his cover story about the tech boom in Olathe, Kansas, in Bloomberg Business Week. Ramesh, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.